improper disposal of household chemicals sickens to Missoula garbage workers. Good evening, I'm Courtney Anderson.
And I'm Sarah Jovetich, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Capital reporter Dan Boyce looks into the decline in the number of Montanans working for minimum wage. Flathead reporter Katrin Fry has a time capsule tale. And in our feature interview, news director Sally Mock talks with the Secretary of Homeland Security, Janet Napolitano, about immigration reform. Two trash collectors in Missoula recently were sickened by gas from household cleaning products they had picked up in the Rattlesnake neighborhood. They were treated and released by St. Patrick Hospital, but it was the second incident involving discarded dangerous chemicals in the last week. That has prompted the city and county health department to issue a reminder to residents to properly dispose of household chemicals. Environmental health specialist Travis Ross says the first incident last Wednesday involved a fuming garbage can in Northside neighborhood.
First responders arrived and interviewed the resident and found that it was an acid cleaner used to clean the side of a building's brick. And so we were able to get that containerized and safely stored until it can be properly disposed of.
The second incident last Thursday occurred when a combination of hazardous waste, including household chemicals, pesticides, and automotive products, ruptured and mixed after being compacted in the garbage truck.
When the garbage collectors loaded it and compacted the waste, it reacted with other items in the bag and released a fume that sickened two workers from Allied Waste.
The two workers are doing fine now, but Ross says people should not believe that just because a household chemical is safe to use, that it can be thrown away in the regular garbage.
Really, they pose risk to the environment, to the workers who collect the garbage, to first responders, to passersby. They're very risky to get rid of that waste.
Ross urges people to dispose of their household chemicals, pesticides, and automotive products during the annual hazardous waste days when the city and county collect the products for safe disposal. This year's collection will be held September 13th and 14th at the city shops on Scott Street. For more information about these dangerous products and how to properly dispose of them, call the health department at 258-4890 or go to Missoula City County Health Department website.
And in other news from around the state, Montana's congressional delegation is split on President Barack Obama's proposal to deal with climate change. The president said today his administration will make rules to curb greenhouse gases emitted by new and existing power plants. Obama says the Keystone XL oil pipeline that would run through Montana will only be approved if the project won't increase overall net emissions of greenhouse gases. U.S. Representative Steve Daines blasted the proposal as, quote, a war on American energy, end quote. The first-term Republican called the plant a job killer. The U.S. Senator John Tester says the country must address climate change and welcomed the president's, quote, kicking off this discussion. The Democrat says he has seen the effect of climate change at his farm with extreme flood, drought, and regional wildfire in recent years. The spokeswoman for Tester says, however, he continues to support the Keystone Pipeline.
A federal judge has blocked another Montana logging project because the U.S. Forest Service and Fish Wildlife Services did not take the proper steps to determine whether lynx may be in the area. Yesterday, U.S. District Judge Dana Christensen halted the timber sale over 15,600 acres in the Big Belt Mountains until two agencies assess whether the projected species may be harmed. Christensen says the agencies concluded lynx did not occupy the area, but the Federal Endangered Species Act requires them to determine merely whether lynx may be present there. It was that same error that led Christensen to block the 30,000-acre project in the Beaverhead Deer Lodge National Forest last month. The Alliance for Wild Rockies and the Native Ecosystems Council sued to stop both logging projects.
A Montana judge says a 6-foot-tall statue of Jesus that was placed on federal land on Big Mountain near Whitefish nearly 60 years ago can remain. U.S. District Judge Dana Christensen ruled the Flathead National Forest can reissue a 10-year permit for the statue installed on the ski hill by the Knights of Columbus, a Catholic men's organization. The Wisconsin-based Freedom from Religion Foundation sued in February 2012, arguing the statue's placement on leased public land violated the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Constitution, which prohibits Congress from making any law regarding an establishment of religion. Christensen ruled yesterday that the statute does not convey to a reasonable informed observer that the government, rather than a private party, endorses Christianity over any other faith or the absence of faith.
The University of Montana's Mountain Campus Bookstore announced this week a reorganization that left 4 longtime employees without jobs. The bookstore at the University of Montana, CEO John O'Leary, blames declining student enrollment, challenging economic times, and a drastically changing textbook industry for the shakeup that's been years in the making.
We're not the sole location to gather your course materials anymore. Competition in the apparel business also has increased. Just the retail landscape in general has changed dramatically across the globe, for that matter, and has impacted in our college store industry as well.
O'Leary says online retailers such as Amazon have been offering students more affordable access to textbooks. He adds even the used textbook market has dramatically declined, leading many to believe that these texts are simply too expensive for most students. These reasons, plus only slightly improved student enrollment projections, prompted the bookstore to make what O'Leary says were difficult decisions.
It was quite a bit of financial strain on our income statement. The bookstore, its balance sheet is actually looking good. It is a healthy organization, but the daily operations were putting a significant financial strain due to decline in sales and revenues, of course. Another aspect of it was given that there was an erosion in our margins, which are profit dollars, which has a direct impact on our profit dollars. We had less profit dollars to operate. So all in all, we had to become more lean and more efficient and right size, and that's what we had to do.
4 long-term full-time employees who were laid off had a combined 80 years of experience at UM's bookstore.
This was not an overnight decision. It was a long, tedious process with a bit of a due diligence process. We tried to get as creative as we could, thinking about furloughs, reduction in week hours worked, so on and so forth. But ultimately, one of the most important criteria that we followed was, would the organization be able to absorb internally with any other additional costs, the responsibilities and duties of all these individuals, and that's how we came up with the names.
O'Leary says the bookstore at the University of Montana patrons may see a few more student employees on the floor or at the registers, but the 4 people who are recently laid off will not be replaced. O'Leary says none of the layoff was performance-based or for cause.
Lewis and Clark County officials have identified the Helena man who died in the crash of a single-engine airplane north of the city. Coroner Mickey Nelson says 51-year-old Leonard Andrew Coyle died on impact. A witness, Don Heidi, says he was outside when he heard the noise from the plane's engine change. He says he looked up and saw the plane spiral down and heard it crash. Nelson said he did not know if Coyle filed a flight plan and that Coyle's wife indicated her husband had just gone flying. Investigators from the National Transportation Safety Board were expected to arrive today to begin investigating the crash.
A national study from the Federal Bureau of Labor Statistics shows Montana's percentage of minimum wage workers shrinking at the fastest rate in the country. The figures show Montana had a 60% reduction in minimum wage workers from 2011 to 2012, during a time when Montana's economy and labor force was growing. But Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us these national figures need to be taken in context.
It's lunchtime at God's Love Homeless Shelter in Helena. A number of people tell me they'd be happy to have a job making the federal minimum wage of $7.25. Brett Herman did recently find some work for more than that.
Taking a roof off a house.
And how much were you getting paid there?
$8 an hour.
That was only for one day, though. However, on this week's 75th anniversary of the Fair Labor Standards Act, which created the minimum wage, on that anniversary, Montana overall seems to be doing a comparatively good job of pushing its labor force out of the minimum wage into higher paid work. A 60% drop in minimum wage workers from 2011 to 2012. A U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics report shows that is more than any other state.
A 60% drop, and that sounds pretty large.
But here's Aaron McNay.
My name is Aaron McNay. I'm an economist for the Department of Labor and Industry.
That's the Montana Department of Labor and Industry. And McNay points out some parts of this report can be misleading. One, he says the Bureau of Labor Statistics was dealing with a pretty small sample size, so the figures could vary a bit. Two, a large percentage change in a low population state like Montana doesn't necessarily mean it's a big number of people.
To some extent, it isn't quite as large of a change as the first glance would seem.
The study shows the number of workers in Montana making at or less than the prevailing federal minimum wage dropped from 10,000 people to 4,000 people. And that actually leads to McNay's next point.
So they're only looking at the federal minimum wage numbers, not taking into account the differences that occur due to state-level minimum wage changes.
The federal minimum wage is $7.25 an hour. During 2011, the year of this study, Montana's minimum wage jumped from $7.35 to $7.65 an hour. McNay says that jump could account for part of that large decline in federal minimum wage earners. Wait, though, that still means in 2012, there were about 4,000 people making at or less than the federal minimum wage, which is already less than the state minimum wage.
Well, there's several things to look at that can result in workers being paid less than minimum wage, and that's perfectly legal.
McNay says there are a number of exceptions to the minimum wage in the state.
One of the big ones for Montana is that businesses or establishments that have net sales of $110,000 or less for the year and don't sell their goods across state lines, they have a minimum wage level that's actually only like $4 an hour.
Also, some workers under 18 in training programs don't make minimum wage. Dependents working in their parents' business or doing chores around the house don't have to. And there are others. All of this is not to say things are not going well for Montana's workforce. They are. Montana's unemployment rate continues to tick downward. It's at 5.4% right now, more than 2% less than the national average. And McNay says Montana's relatively strong recovery from the Great Recession has likely had the effect of raising wages. Back at God's Love Shelter, Dana Norman is finishing up her meal. She's just started making higher wages.
Got a job at McDonald's making $8.50 an hour.
That's 50 cents more than her last job and 70 cents more than the current Montana minimum wage of $7.80 an hour. She's happy for it. But she's still not making enough to turn down the free lunches from the shelter.
Because I don't get food stamps, and it's where I just started this job, and it's right now it's a difficult time for me, so till I can actually get up off my feet at this job. So
she says she is making a living wage, just barely. I'm Dan Boyce, reporting at the Capitol.
Federal prosecutors have charged a Montana Hutterite colony with possessing two illegally killed grizzly bears. The documents filed today in U.S. District Court in Great Falls charge the Ponderay colony near Valier and five of its members. One of the defendants, Minister Leonard Kleinsasser, told U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service agent the bears died from exhaustion. Kleinsasser says half of the colony members were chasing the bears prior to their deaths in September. Kleinsasser says they did not report the deaths because they were scared. The documents say the bears were buried after a failed attempt to cremate one of them. A collar on the other bear was removed, smashed, and burned. The penalty for each of the two charges is 6 months in prison and a $25,000 fine.
A power outage at a fish hatchery in northwestern Montana resulted in the deaths of about 160,000 fish that will affect fish stocking in the Eureka and Libby area for the next 2 years. The Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks Department says the Sunday morning power outage resulted in the pumps at Murray Springs State Fish Hatchery near Eureka to be shut off for 3.5 hours. A backup generator failed to start. The loss included 30,000 7 to 8 inch rainbow trout destined for Lake Coconusa, 47,000 2-inch rainbow trout, and some 2-year-old future brood fish that will impact next year's red band spawn. The loss also includes 6,000 10-inch West Slope cutthroat trout and about 50,000 2.5-inch rainbow trout. Some of the loss will be mitigated by the use of surplus fish from other hatcheries.
A renovation project turns up a surprising discovery at the University of Montana's Flathead Lake Biological Station. Flathead reporter Katrin Fry takes us to the Research Center and Living Classroom on Yellow Bay.
On the corner of the Flathead Lake Biological Station's main building is a cornerstone made of granite with the year 1967 chiseled into its smooth face. It got removed during a recent renovation of the Elrod building.
We thought it just meant that it was built in '67.
Dr. Jack Stanford started directing the biological station in 1980 after being handpicked by former director, Dr. Richard Solberg.
I'd forgotten all about it. I'd forgotten that we ever did such a thing. And one day, Jack called me and said, "You got to stop by. We're digging around in the building and we found this time capsule."
The time capsule had been sealed into the wall behind the granite cornerstone since the Elrod building was built during Dr. Solberg's tenure as the biostation director. The 1967 time capsule had scientific papers from the time, as well as a state of the station report. In that report, Dr. Solberg lists the budget for the station at $54,000. Stanford says now he has a $500,000 budget.
Well, if you consider that the inflation is about an order of magnitude, my budget's less than his was.
Solberg used a $150,000 National Science Foundation grant to build the Elrod building in 1967. It was replacing the so-called old brick lab from 1912. That went up during the tenure of Dr. Morton Elrod as director. Solberg oversaw the tearing down of the old lab and the building of the new lab, and they had found a time capsule from 1912 containing scientific reports from the time, as well as a guest list from the ribbon-cutting ceremony. Guests at that ceremony likely came by boat, as Highway 35, running along the East Shore, was still being built by convicts. The total construction costs in 1967 are listed at $115,000. The 2010 remodel, which includes many energy efficiency upgrades like insulation and lighting, tallies up to $467,000. The station was founded in 1899 on Yellow Bay, and it's seen a lot of changes in its 100-year-plus history. Besides the new lodgings and new lab, Dr. Stanford says another thing that's changed is the lake itself. Dr. Solberg says during his tenure in 1962 through 1969, staff and students were studying native fish like the West Slope cutthroat trout. Dr. Stanford says that's changed.
Yeah, when I became director in 1980 and my graduate work here the decade before that, bull trout and cutthroat trout were common in the lake. You can't find one today.
West Slope cutthroat and bull trout still live in the Flathead River and lake system, but are few and far between with invasive species like rainbow and lake trout taking over. Solberg says in the first half of the station's life, the focus was on teaching. Now, they're still teaching, but research plays a central role at the station. Stanford says their research has spread to rivers and streams in different countries and continents, and the ongoing studies in the Flathead system have relevance and repercussions beyond Montana's borders.
The biodiversity is very high in the crown of the continent because it's right square on the water tower of the whole continent. It's where everything seems to begin. The Triple Divide Peak in Glacier Park is a significant feature because water flows from there to Hudson's Bay and to the Mississippi and then to the Columbia.
Who knows when the cornerstone at the Elrod Lab will next be cracked, maybe in 50 more years. When it is, they'll find a list of people who were at this dedication ceremony, another State of the Station report, published scientific studies, water samples, a University of Montana staff pin, a 2013 quarter, and a bottle of scotch. A former student found a cask of scotch aged 34 years in Scotland, brought it back to the States, and it was rebottled with a Monty Dolak print.
And the view is a view down on the other side of the lake, of Flathead Lake. So we thought it would be appropriate to put that kind of water in the time capsule for us and to include with it three vials of Flathead Lake raw water for reference purposes 50 years from now or whenever it is that they decide this building is no longer useful.
34 years is also nearly the amount of time Stanford has been the director at the biological station. For Montana Evening Edition, Katrin Fright reporting from the Flathead.
As reported earlier, the U.S. Senate is expected to pass an immigration reform bill later this week. The bill faces stiff opposition in the Republican-led House, where bipartisan support is harder to come by. Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano is among the Obama administration officials lobbying for passage of the bill. In tonight's feature interview, she talks with News Director Sally Mock about the main objections to the immigration reform bill, reform legislation moving through the Senate.
One of the objections for opponents is that the path to citizenship for the 11 million undocumented workers in this country is a problem for them. They think that's unfair to those who've come to this country and applied legally.
Yeah, I think the answer to that is you have to look at the bill as a whole. And the plain fact of the matter is the way the bill works, that people who are already illegally in the country would have the opportunity to register. They pay fines and fees at that point, but they ultimately don't get their green card in the path to citizenship for a period of between 10 and 13 years from when the bill is enacted, which is more than sufficient to be effectively the back of the line in many respects. So it's a provision that allows us to deal firmly and fairly with those already in the country, but also, you know, boosts our border security quite a bit and then fixes a lot of the visa problems that everybody has been experiencing and that our country has sorely needed to be addressed over the last few years.
Speaking of the visa problem, some opponents have an objection to that as well, saying that you're really making it too easy for skilled workers to get visas and they would displace potential American workers.
Well, first of all, the visa portions of the bill were carefully negotiated between labor and business so as not to displace American workers, and that's why labor and business both support the bill. The bill has a number of provisions in the high-tech arena requiring employers to first make sure they have tried to find an American worker before they can get another H-1B visa.
Senate passage of the bill is likely, House passage not so likely. Is that how you see it as well, and how do you get House Republicans that you need on board?
Well, I think it's hard to predict the House at this point in time. We're encouraged by what the Senate has been doing, you know, addressing this in a bipartisan fashion. Four Democrats, four Republicans came up with the original construct of a comprehensive bill that included the principles that President Obama has wanted. The committee then heard it and made a number of amendments to it. It moved to the floor, where it again has bipartisan support. On the House side, whether they pass their own comprehensive bill or smaller bills or what have you, we really don't know at this point. But I think the important thing is, look, it's a big problem. It's been festering in our country for a long time. It needs to be addressed. It needs to be addressed comprehensively and in a bipartisan fashion. We are, you know, moving down the road toward that goal.
And what are the consequences, Madam Secretary, of failure for the country and for the security of the country?
Well, if you like the immigration system the way it currently works, that's what would happen. And so we would continue to have critical shortages of labor where we need it most. We would continue to have a large group of people already in the country, but we don't have their identities and their biometrics. We would like to have those. And we would continue to lack the full input of immigrants into our economy in a way that is productive and helps our economy grow. You know, there was a CBO study, Congressional Budget Office study last week that showed that if this bill were to pass, it would contribute almost another $200 billion to deficit reduction in the first 10 years and $700 billion-plus in the second 10 years. It's a real economic growth bill.
The final provision of the bill that gets the most discussion, of course, is the improved border security. You're confident that the bill would provide security to the border that doesn't exist now?
Yes, we have records amount of manpower and technology at the border now. The bill that was originally constructed by the Gang of Eight, the four Democrats and four Republicans, added to that. In the amendment process, the Senate has added even more to that. So this will be the strongest border security bill in our nation's history.
Well, I have been speaking with Secretary of Homeland Security Janet Napolitano. Madam Secretary, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
In tonight's weather forecast, for west of the Divide, tonight will be mostly cloudy with a chance of rain, showers, and isolated thunderstorms. Lows will be in the mid-40s to lower 50s. Tomorrow, expect mostly cloudy skies with a chance of rain, showers. Highs will be in the 70s. For central Montana, tonight will be partly cloudy with a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms. Lows will stick around 50 degrees. Tomorrow, expect more partly cloudy skies with a slight chance of rain, showers. Highs will be between 70 and 80 degrees. And for southwest Montana, tonight will be mostly cloudy with the chance of showers and thunderstorms, with lows between 40 to 50 degrees. Tomorrow, expect partly cloudy skies with a slight chance of rain showers throughout the day. Highs will be around 75 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Sterling Holy White Mountain.
EOED, that beautiful and extraordinary record of the English language, marks the first known written use of the word powwow by Englishman E. Winslow in the year 1624. In referring to a tribal spiritual leader, most likely of the Narragansett tribe, being that is where the word comes from, he says, "The office and duty of the powwow is to be exercised principally in calling upon the devil and curing diseases of the sick or wounded." Later in 1647, the OED has a T. Shepherd saying, "The Indians have utterly forsaken all their powwows and given over that diabolical exercise." Though we are still well over 100 years from the colony's war for independence from the British, and thus also that many years away from people beginning to call themselves Americans, we can see already in the written record the beginnings of the two conflicted threads that have come to define the American relationship to American Indians, the threads which Indians have been forced to deal with since what now seems like time immemorial. The word powwow for the Narragansetts in Massachusetts refers to a man who is a spiritual leader and healer within the tribe. More often than not, this man, the powwow, was referred to by the British and later Americans as a kind of wizard or witch, and was believed to participate in devil worship that needed to be stamped out. As the word powwow made its way into larger American culture, it took on connotations more familiar to us now. Initially, this expansion in meaning meant the word referred to any significant gathering of Indians involving tribal leaders, spiritual leaders, or healers. Eventually, the term simply referred to any gathering of Indians, regardless of the intent of the Indians themselves. In this shift in meaning, I see the beauty of the human capacity to add new meanings to words whose sounds remain essentially unchanged. But I also feel the frustration of many American Indians at so rarely being able to speak for themselves. By 1812, powwow was being used to refer to American social and political gatherings that had nothing to do with Indian ceremony. The OED marks this transition by quoting the Salem Gazette, which referred to a local political function as a gathering of democratic warriors who would soon be holding a powwow, which in turn marked the word's final assimilation into larger American culture. By 1871, the treaty-making era between the U.S. government and the tribes had officially come to a close, and the assimilation era, a period that brought with it that set of policies intended to turn American Indians into Americans, was in full swing. At the same time, government agents on reservations were actively suppressing the dance traditions of tribes as part of assimilation policy. Indians were joining any of 50 traveling Wild West shows, the most famous of which was Buffalo Bill Cody's. Participating in these shows allowed tribal members to dance in a way that was publicly acceptable, allowed the dancers to travel and get off of reservations and make money, but most importantly gave them opportunity to continue the long-standing tradition of dance. A salient fact regarding these Wild West shows was the dancers themselves could potentially control at least some of the context in which they performed, a rare moment in the 19th century for an Indian to have some power over how he or she might be perceived by the larger public. Buffalo Bill's shows also provided a template that today's powwow's attendees would find recognizable, as each show began with a grand entry parade, usually with Indians riding horses. The shows also somewhat mirrored older types of pre-reservation era gatherings, when tribal members would gather in the summer months to celebrate, participate in ceremonies, and spend time with relatives, a mirroring that surely allowed for those participating to feel that not everything had been lost. By the time we reached the 1930s, powwows began to take on the celebratory form most recognizable to us today, with structures determined largely by the tribes themselves, which is another way of saying Indians finally had an opportunity to present themselves to Americans as they wished to be seen and in their own way. It is a freedom resulting directly from the federal policy of that era, which stated tribes should be allowed to continue their respective religious and ceremonial practices without interference. It is a special freedom to consider in relation to the centuries of cultural dismissal and oppression that had preceded it. But it is also a peculiarly bright light when considered in relation to the termination era that was about to commence as the 1940s came to a close and federal Indian policy shifted yet again toward finding a permanent end to the so-called Indian problem through tribal termination, and then shifted yet again in the 1970s to the current so-called self-determination era. One of the things I would like for anyone listening today to take with them is the remarkable fact that these dances exist at all. And the fact that these dances continue to exist is due to refusal of Indian individuals to abandon their respective cultural practices in the face of negative federal policy. It is because of the refusal of those men and women whose names are lost in the darkness of unrecorded history that we are able to witness the beauty of these dancers today. As for what the dances might mean, if you find yourself at a powwow, I would encourage you to do something that hardly anyone has ever done when it comes to Indian affairs. Ask an Indian, and then ask another. I'm Sterling Holy White Mountain. Thank you for listening.
Sterling Holy White Mountain is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Courtney Anderson.
And I'm Sarah Jovetich. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.